Welcome to Synthaholics. This is your host, David Duncan, and with me today is Guy Davis.
Hello.
It's been a while. How have you been, man?
I've been great. It's our first snow day here in Denver.
And it's a nice 65 degrees here in Buffalo, which makes no sense. Makes absolutely no sense.
I know. The world is topsy-turvy.
Topsy-turvy. Yeah, you got snow before us, although you are at a higher altitude, so that's kind of cheating.
It is. And, you know, you're at a higher altitude if you look at a map on the wall, though.
Yeah. That's a higher longitude, I think. So Aaron unfortunately can't be with us today. Work thing came up, and he was not able to get to us at the moment. So we miss you, Aaron. Sorry you couldn't be here.
Yeah, we do.
And I am under the weather, so excuse me for sounding like a frog.
Yeah, he's under the weather that I have.
I wish. It's your first time on since we've talked Discovery. So what is your thoughts been on the show so far?
Well, I have been an avid fan of Discovery since it started, because of course this is for me. It's the first time we've had Star Trek in 15 years, and I've just been
12 years so since it went off the air, but yeah, 15 yeah. since the other show started. Yeah,
yeah. Well, yeah, you're right. Yeah, well, roughly 15 years, give or take. And I really just kind of wanted to change my attitude towards Star Trek. I'm getting too old to be grumpy about Star Trek, so I decided to change my attitude on it and just enjoy it. Which has changed the way I view Discovery, but it hasn't let me down. It's been very, very good, in my opinion. The first two episodes, The Vulcan Hello and The Battle of the Binary Stars, I felt were interesting, but not really engaging necessarily. Context is for Kings was just incredible. At that point in time, I was like,
this is what we're doing.
So once they hit Context is for Kings, I was like, well, now I see where you guys are headed. And so I am totally on board now with these guys. I mean, I was willing to be happy and blissful and watch Star Trek before, but now I'm definitely on board. So
absolutely. That's pretty much how Aaron and I were the first two episodes. Just they weren't bad, and I enjoyed them, but I was trying to view them through the lens of the non-fan, which is, I assume, what they want to attract, which is why they put that free episode on TV, so they could attract non-fans. And I feel like, as much as I enjoyed it, I feel like it just wasn't enough. Because the third episode did more than the first two combined.
I don't really actually think, and this is my little deep down in my soul feeling, I don't think they're really after the non-fans this time. What happened with Enterprise was they kept trying to go after the non-fans, and they went after the non-fans, and what they ended up with was uncomfortable sex scenes between T'Pol and Tucker.
That didn't happen until season 3 or 4. So I mean,
right? But that was put in there, and the kind of weird sex scenes of putting, you know, lotion on each other, and
it puts lotion on its skin.
I know, and it was like, and I mean, not to say that sex and that kind of stuff is not welcome in Star Trek. It just felt forced. It felt unreal. It felt unnatural. And the the thing that I felt was that they were putting that in there to try to Dawson's Creek up Star Trek.
Sexify it.
Yeah, they were trying to draw in viewers. And I remember the commercials at the time were very sexy, and they were clearly trying to sexy up the show, and it wasn't that wasn't natural. And so what I think was happening was they were trying to keep the viewership above the 10 million line.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't. They just could not keep the viewership holding above the 10 million line, and that's what caused Enterprise to fall. With CBS All Access, they don't have to. They only need to keep about 1 million of us. And that's it. And so, you know, I don't think they need to worry about it. They just need to keep a million of us.
The only thing I'm worried about is that they haven't officially greenlit a second season yet.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I was talking to Doug Jones about that. And it's interesting because the scuttlebutt is that they've greenlit a second season. I mean, there's chatter that they've – but even Doug Jones hasn't heard that they have greenlit a second season.
Well, even the interviews with the writers and the producers, they haven't I mean, like, they keep talking about we've got, you know, plot points figured out for where our second season's going to go. And even, like, a week or two before the show came out, they were talking about second season's going to be post-war. But there's been no actual green light, and I don't know why they haven't. I mean – If they've got all the subscribers they're going to get, I would hope we should know one way or the other, especially since Netflix fully funded the first season on its own. So I would assume a second season would have been, you know, a no-brainer since they already made money on it.
And I am curious where the scuttlebutt is coming from that says that Netflix has funded the second season of Discovery.
No. I'm talking about the first season. The first season was totally funded through Netflix.
Yeah, but I've seen articles pop up saying that Netflix has paid for second season.
Oh, I've not seen that. That's interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's scuttlebutt. I mean, it's totally not. This isn't coming from on high, because like I said, Doug Jones hasn't heard that either.
Yeah.
And nobody has heard that. So clearly, this isn't official by any stretch of the imagination. So. It makes me wonder, you know, where did you hear this from? Where did this come from? Where, you know, who's hearing this information that makes them think that the second season's been greenlit?
I hope it gets greenlit soon. I'm hoping they'll announce something soon. I just can't wait to hear that because I'm loving the show so much. And I do disagree a little bit. I mean, I understand what you mean. We're talking about Enterprise Omega. They're trying to sexify it. But TOS was probably the most sexy Star Trek until Enterprise. And there was a lot of sexy in TOS. And I think they were trying to bring that back, but maybe push the envelope a little bit because, you know, it's got, you know, 40 years on the original show, so they can push things a little bit further since the sensibilities of the 60s are different than the sensibilities of the early aughts.
Oh, well, and there's nothing – and like I said, there's nothing wrong with sex in Star Trek.
It's implied all over the place. It's just
– sure. So I'm not trying to say that there's something wrong with that. Not that there's anything wrong with that, quoting Seinfeld. The problem I had was that it was forced. It felt like they were trying to – and this is coming from me being in my late 20s. I was part of the target audience at the time. And I was watching this going, where are you guys going with this? They brought Seven of Nine in the same way in Voyager, and I was in my mid-20s during that time.
Yeah.
And it was not the show itself. It was the advertising I took umbrage with. Because the show, it was a little forced. They were trying, and they were kind of failing and falling short. But the advertising was so stilted. And it was clear that they were trying to bring in people, they were trying to bring in non-Trekkies. They were really trying to bring in non-Trekkies. And looking back in a forensic way, especially when you read sort of some of the overview of what happened to Star Trek and sort of where people were seeing how things happened and you know, like what was it that I was reading? I was reading These Are the Voyages, and not These Are the Voyages. There was another one that I was reading. I can't even remember. My wife borrowed it from the library. But it was the what happened in the later parts of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
And Berman was talking about how hard it was to keep Enterprise on the air with the schisms of the Trekkies and the Trekkies being very upset and everything like this and this whole thing going on. But he was also having a hard time keeping the numbers up, keeping the viewership numbers,
mm-hmm.
which is the whole point behind CBS All Access. They only need a tenth of the viewership on CBS All Access. They don't even need a tenth of the viewership to keep Discovery at its current rate. They don't even need that much, which is where Netflix is going and where everybody's going. I mean, if you have Netflix has a lot of buying power in a TV show by charging everybody $5 a month. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They only need to have a fraction of what CBS needs in broad broadcasting power as far as money goes. So this is a major shift in the way everything goes. Discovery only needs 1 million viewers. And 1 million of us is nothing across the entire globe. I mean, there's 8 billion people.
Well, All Access is relegated to just North America, though.
Yeah, but what we talk about Netflix, too.
Yeah.
Netflix has already bought in at that point in time. So All Access and Netflix and all of those things, you add all of those together and you get enough that they've paid off their bills to get this without needing to do anything further. So my theory here is they've never really targeted anybody but the Trekkies. And that is evident. Evident. By the number of things. I mean, my goodness.
Well, I just Michael thought that
Burnham,
I thought
crawling the, through she's crawling through the Jeffries tubes and she's quoting Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, that's which very Star Trek.
Directly to an animated episode from TAS.
Yeah.
She's referencing TAS. And I'm like sitting there, my mind is blown. I'm like sitting there going, oh my God, she's referencing a TAS episode.
But the thing is, I mean, even if it's not referencing TAS, it's just very Star Trek-y for them to do that anyway, you know, with quoting Moby Dick and Star Trek First Contact and other things like that. I mean, like quoting, you know, old literature is very, very Star Trek.
Well, Spock had said that Amanda used to read Lewis Carroll to him all the time.
Yeah.
But he said that in TAS.
Yeah, but I mean, it's even more direct with that TAS reference, for sure.
Uh-huh.
So, first we're going to go non-spoiler first reactions to The Butcher's Knife Cares Not for the Lamb's Cry. So, just non-spoiler first reactions. What did you think on that?
Non-spoilerly.
Yeah, we try to do the first bit of the episode non-spoilery so that people
can... So, if you have not seen it yet,
you can
go see it.
Yeah, go see it, and then you can come back and get the rest of it.
If you've not seen it yet, just go see it. Let's see, non-spoilerly.
First reactions, just this episode.
I really loved the episode. We're definitely getting deeper and wider with the ideas and the concepts. They're bringing in focus where I think they're headed with this show. I guess what we had talked about before... When you were saying that the first, you know, the Vulcan Hello and the Battle of the Binary Stars feels like a prologue, and these two episodes, Context is for Kings and The Butcher's Knife, they feel very much like now we're really talking about what's going on.
Absolutely.
So that's my first impression is in the first real episode, if you will, after the prologue.
Yeah.
In the first real episode last week, we got to see the little bit of what's going on here. And The Butcher's Knife has really expanded that. It got in there and pushed it further wide.
It absolutely has.
It also twisted some of my theories. I had some solid theories of where Lorca was going, and it turned them backwards on me. So that was kind of cool. I'm liking the fact that I was proven wrong by Lorca. I thought Lorca was going one way, and he wasn't. And I'll expand that a little further later on in the show when we get into our spoiler zone.
Fly into the spoiler zone. No, absolutely, absolutely. Before we get there, I absolutely love this episode, too. It is building, you know, head and shoulders on Contexas for Kings. Contexas for Kings was amazing. Aaron and I both loved it. It just... it felt like finally something had happened. Like, you know, the first two episodes were great, but I just felt like I hadn't seen anything yet. I felt like I'd still just seen the trailers, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It just still felt like a really long trailer for what was going to be coming. And now that we're into the meat of it, it's absolutely amazing. I think I know where you're going with the Lorca thing, because after that first episode, I felt like Lorca was my favorite captain just for that one episode, because he seems like he's multi-layered. And yeah, I still think he is.
I had him pegged, and he turned the other direction.
I think we might still have him pegged. We don't know. But it just – he's so good. He's absolutely fantastic. It's hard not to talk about this episode without giving too many spoilers, although we do know this was going to feature Klingons. We finally get to see Cole for longer than a few minutes, so that's fantastic. Cole is an awesome Klingon. We get to see Vok, the albino again, and Laurel. I've seen people online complain that, you know, that them speaking Klingon is bad and their acting is bad because they're speaking in Klingon. And I think Laurel sold her feelings and her through even speaking Klingon. Like, I think they're doing an amazing job acting with the Klingon dialogue, because they know the English that they're saying. It's not like they're oblivious to it, because they did rehearse it, from what I understand. They did rehearse the lines in English before filming it in Klingon.
I mean, this is a double hard thing, but I remember Rene Auberjonois talking about practicing in Juilliard with mask, you know, having to practice with makeup. That's a skill that actors get, and they're good at expressing and emoting with their eyes only, because that prosthetic is huge on their forehead. So
I think Laurel's makeup even changed a bit from the first episode, because
I think it has to,
because like some of the stills that were from the first episode, I couldn't tell Laurel was a female. Like, now I can definitely tell she's a woman. Her makeup
loosened up her forehead a little.
Oh, and around her mouth, too, because that's – I mean, the forehead's not going out where you're going to see the angles of a woman. Usually you see it, like how the jawline is shaped and stuff like that. You can see more of her face, and you can definitely tell that she's a woman now. It was in the first episode. I wasn't too sold on just by looking at her if she was a woman or not. It was kind of like makeup's kind of weird, but I think they refined it a little bit in the second episode. She's absolutely amazing, Mary Chifo. She's – I can't wait to see more Laurel. And Cole, they're both fantastic. So I can't really talk anything else about the episode without getting to spoiler land. So Aaron,
now's your time.
So now we're getting to spoiler land. So if you want to turn off and revisit us once you've seen the episode, now is the time to do that. So yeah, Aaron is not here, but he did send me his notes for the recap. So I'll be reading that. So it'll be weird me going through the recap, but here he goes. The episode opens, which appears to be an electrical storm. However, the camera pulls out, and eventually it's Burnham's new uniform being replicated, which is so cool.
Yeah,
to see how like it being built up like the molecular level. It was so neat. I was like, what is this? Are they flying through a storm? And they're like, nope.
Nope, we are building a new uniform.
You know, Tilly comes in with a big like luggage thing, and it turns out it's the last will and testimony of Captain Georgiou, and she doesn't want to open it. She sticks it under her bed, and then she goes to the turbo lift, and she runs into Saru, and Saru is all about that gangly on his head.
Yep.
He is still convinced that she's going to mess them up somehow.
Yeah, he's sure. Well, and justifiably so. I mean, he's you know, he's been threatened by her, I guess. So
I don't think
her enough of a chance, do you?
I don't think so. Like, I love Saru. I like the character a lot, but I just feel like the first couple episodes, you know, War with the Klingons was going to happen no matter what. It doesn't matter what she did. She kind of like made a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it just kind of came, and I don't know. I just feel like it was going to happen anyway. Like, I feel it's kind of like almost manufactured. Like, the one problem I have, I guess, with the plot is that I just feel like everything's manufacturedly against Michael Burnham because of her one action. But, I mean, the war has already happened. Like, what's the point of mutinying now? The only reason she was mutinying to begin with was to try to, like, save everybody. Now the war's already happened. I feel like she doesn't pose any threat that way anymore.
Well, I think that – I feel like that Saru's response – and we were rabbit-holing – but this is
rabbit-holing
because you and I haven't had a chance to discuss this before. So forgive us for rabbit-holing. I feel like that Saru's problem stems from the fact that, from his point of view, here was a safe environment on a safe ship doing Starfleet
normal things,
happy stuff.
Yeah.
One day, and then before you know it, you had your first officer and your captain literally at gunpoint with one another just before Klingons started shooting at you and everything started going to hell in a handbasket. So I can kind of see that to him, you know, especially being from a race of already kind of high strung, a little bit freaked out sort of people, she's threatening. She caused, in his mind's eye, I can perceive it. He's more sensitive because it doesn't seem like the rest of the humans are quite as reactive as he is.
Well, especially after contact us for King, she's kind of proving herself not to be as bad a person as everyone's made her out to be.
Right. I mean, it seems like that they're not as freaked out as he is. It's going to take him longer, which actually makes me like the character more because they're not just flipping him back over. Okay, he's good.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I love the character. I just think everything's kind of been manufactured against her. Just because of how it is. Like, that's the one plot point that I'm not super sold on. They're just all blaming her for something that was pretty much going to happen anyway. But she also probably took full responsibility for it in the court-martial, so it's kind of like, well, you kind of did just take it all on yourself.
The nice thing is, when I was watching the episode, I had the benefit of watching it with a guy who happens to be a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. And so there is some very unique viewpoints to having an actual active army person there. And his statement was, as soon as she said guilty, he was like, well, that's it. She's a mutineer. I mean, those were his words. Bam. Right there. I mean,
yeah, she pled guilty. Yeah.
Yeah, so it doesn't really matter at that point in time.
Sure.
what the context was or what was going on. The military is going to view her in a certain way that changes automatically. So,
which is why I love Lorca's line, universal laws for lackeys, context is for kings. And I'm like, yes.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what Lorca was saying.
I'm in love with you, Lorca. You're amazing.
Yeah. Lorca's pretty much saying, you know what, you know, the army can sit there and say that you pled guilty and whatever, 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 whatever. We're going to sit there and say, I know you didn't really mean to hurt what was going on here. In other words, all the audience knew you were on the right side.
Yeah.
I knew you were on the right side.
Absolutely.
The story seems to think you're not.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah, so I like that. That was cool.
Absolutely. So they get to the bridge, and Lorca's in the middle of doing some drills to the Klingons. They lose, and the security officer Landry is like, we'll try to do better next time. And Lorca's like, it'll be hard to do worse. I literally started laughing at this point. And I'm like, oh, Lorca. Lorca's just burning them.
Yeah, Lorca just burns everybody. Boy, he just chews on everybody.
I love him. He's such a great captain. He is so fantabulous. So anyway, he puts Saru in charge of the next couple things, the next couple simulations, and he takes Michael down to his little shop of horrors, which I called it from the last episode, which I thought was crazy that they brought this up almost immediately in the episode. And he's basically tasked her with weaponizing whatever that monster is behind that blast shield, because if it can withstand kill shots from a phaser, Klingon batleths, and if it can claw through you know, whatever metals the ships are made of with no issue. This thing should be made into a weapon, and that's what he's given her to do.
Which makes some sense, and is consistent with what we've saw in Contexts for Kings.
It's interesting that the creature has a natural aversion to light. Act 2 starts, we've got Vok and Laurel aboard the Klingon, aboard Takuvma's ancient ship. And they've been sitting there for 6 months in the debris field, and they're just like, well, we're starving, we don't have any dilithium matrix to make our ship go. And Laurel's like, just go to the Shinsho. And he's like, no, we can't do that. We can't contaminate the ship. And I'm like, and Laurel makes a very good point. She's like, look, I'm from two different houses. I built bridges. Being pure isn't worth dying over. We've got to be, if we're going to, you know, take this to Kronos, if we're going to make this, you know, spread to Kuvma's religion and spread his holy war, we have to, you know, be alive to do it. So they eventually decide to go over to the other ship.
Which I get the impression that it wasn't about polluting by mixing non-Klingon. It was about polluting by mixing with the enemies.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, it's technology. Technology is technology. Like, you need a dilithium matrix to make your ship go. I mean, it doesn't matter who made it. You need a dilithium matrix. And I know that was Takuvma's thing, purity, but I thought that was purity of blood and purity of culture. A ship part is a ship part, you know what I mean? Like, you go to AutoZone, you pick up a part. If the part fits, you know, I don't know enough about cars to care who made it. I just need it to fit my car, and I need it to work so I can drive to and fro.
I wonder where Takuvma got the cloaking device.
That's interesting, too. I hope they go into that, because they're the only ones with cloaking devices, which is interesting. Yeah,
clearly that was brought up in this particular episode, too.
It cuts back to Discovery, and we've got Landry joining Burnham in the armory. She wants to help weaponize the creature, and she wants to make sure that Michael is not being too, sciency. Don't be too curious. Let's get to work. Lorca gets a call from the Admiral. They have a distress call from the dilithium mining colony, Korvan 2. They're under attack by the Klingons. Discovery's the only ship nearby, and nearby is, you know, loosely, because the only reason they're nearby is because they have the experimental spore drive. He goes to Captain Lorca goes to Stamets, and Stamets is like, well, we'll try, but I don't know how to do it. So they warp into the sun, basically a sun's ionosphere. They're not at Korvan 2, so stuff happens. They get out, and they warp out of there. Back with the Klingons, Cole warps in. Does this whole weird, like, false humility thing? Like, I didn't quite get Cole. Maybe he didn't realize the situation and was just going to evaluate the situation. Because he comes in, he's like, he bows, and says, oh, I was talking about all this stuff. I was talking smack, you know, I'm sorry. For talking smack to all you guys.
I think he was trying to lull them into a false sense of security.
That's probably a good point. So that happens. They talk about being starving. They talk about the cloaks and you know, how they're going to, you know, join together. Klingon mach. Remain Klingon. And they do their chant. Meanwhile, back on Discovery.
It's interesting. Korvan 2 shows up again, but it shows up in a TNG episode, as a side note, while you're looking.
Yeah, I did look that up on Memory Alpha. Like, where does it show up, Korvan 2?
And New Ground.
Yeah.
Season, episode 10.
Anyway, when they did that original jump into the star, Michael noticed that the creature started, like, acting weird, and it kind of reared up, and it was, like, shrieking in terror or pain or something. And when Landry comes back down, she shows her what's going on with the creature. And, you know, she thinks there's some correlation between the spores and the creature. And Landry's like, no, it probably just didn't want to jump into a star. And it doesn't like light, so it doesn't want to be too close to a star. And Landry's like, oh, we're going to anesthetize this thing, and we're going to start cutting off its claws so we can study it, because you're not making progress fast enough. And Lorca demands progress.
Right.
She anesthetizes, she grabs a phaser, she grabs some kind of other Klingon knife, and as soon as the shield comes down, it comes barreling out and tries to get through the door. Landry shoots it and then gets mauled by the creature, and then thrown through the desk. Luckily, Michael's like, oh yeah, it doesn't like light. So he turns on the light, she shuts it back in its pen, emergency beams to sick bay, and Landry is dead, Jim.
Yeah, boy.
Landry, oh my gosh.
Killed off.
I couldn't believe she died in just two episodes.
We loved Landry. I was really digging Landry.
I loved Landry. I was like, she's like the Tasha that we should have gotten, like the badass security officer.
Should have gotten, and we wiped out Landry. And I'm like, dang it, I liked her.
Like, we are in a post Game of Thrones world, guys. This shouldn't have surprised me because this is what I've been saying leading up to Discovery for over a year now. We're in a post Game of Thrones world. Nobody is safe.
Sure.
And even though I've been saying this, I was still shocked when she died. Because she's kind of a bigger actress for the show. And I think she's one of the ones I've actually heard of. And I've seen her in other things. So, like, for her to die, like, in only two episodes, that blew me away. So,
I was shocked. I was, like, totally shocked.
It was brutal, too. Like, she was ripped.
It was a brutal death.
She was ripped open all sorts of ways. I like that Star Trek's stepping into this more realistic. Now,
to be fair, I mean, I hate to say this, but the inner GM in me has to say, to be fair, she did, like, say, I've had it with this. I'm going to go over there and, like, go against the scientist who's saying, I don't think it's asleep yet, and shoot at it.
Yeah. You know
what I mean? To be fair, she did, like,
she did roll a couple of ones on her perception check.
On her perception check there.
And it
wasn't exactly one of the top 10.
And her street smarts also rolled a one on. Yeah, she rolled a bunch of ones.
Rolled a bunch of ones there. The inner GM in me says I probably would have killed her off too. She wasn't doing some brilliant stuff there.
Sure, but I mean that just speaks to how she knows Lorca and how Lorca needs results. Right. And she's right. Like,
to me, it felt like Lorca was pushing her too hard. Not that this was an unrealistic character death, which means that the writing is still pretty solid.
Oh yeah. Like, I mean, it wasn't that she was being stupid because she was stupid. It's like, she knows she has to get results and she has to get Michael to get results. Otherwise, you know, it's her ass, you know?
Right. Well, and we've seen with Stamos that Lorca is pushing really, really hard.
Pushing everyone really hard, which is...
And Michael, and we've had bosses. I mean, everybody has had a boss like this.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's had one of these bosses who's like, you know, your job's on the line. Do this. And you're like, it's impossible. And you're like, and the boss is like, your job is on the line. You will do it or you will be fired. And you're like, well, crap, I'm going to end up fired. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And
yeah.
And of course this, you know, Lorca's upped the ante here. It's not just you're fired. You'll be dead. You know, he's upping the ante on these things.
Exactly.
He does these psychological games too. I mean, which we haven't gotten to because you haven't read it yet.
Yeah. I think actually this probably happened earlier.
That's the scene right now.
After the jump, but after Landry dies, he's like, you know, look, you know, don't let her death be in vain. And then also Stamets, I think this was earlier, but Stamets got his nose broken whenever they jumped into the sun. And he comes in and talks to him about what needs to be done. And, while they're arguing, oh, I'm going to take all my stuff away. Like, Starfleet owns all this. You can't do anything, dude. I love Lorca.
And then Lorca then says, I want you to play back on the speakers for everybody to hear.
What's happening in Korvan, too.
Going, help us, we're all dying.
That's
psychological crap. I mean, Lorca is messing with the crew of the Discovery.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's amazing. It's beautiful. He's being effective.
He is being totally effective. There's no question.
He is unlike any other captain we've ever seen, and I love him for it.
Yeah, I mean, I had an idea of where Lorca was going in Contexts for Kings, but this has changed where I think he's going in this episode, and I love it. I love where he's going. Don't get me wrong. He is. I'm of the opinion that the large arc of where Discovery is going is exploring what you have to do in a war.
Yeah.
And how much of you are you willing to sacrifice? to win. And Lorca has already decided that he is willing to sacrifice his entire humanity to win.
Well, he's all in. But, I mean, I think he's also part of Section 31. And I think Section 31, they just give up their souls.
Well, that's
like, upon joining Section 31, you've pretty much given up your soul to the devil at that point. So, I mean,
I think so too. But that's the whole thing about Section 31 is that you have decided you're all in.
Exactly.
The line that has been talked about, and this is something that's ancient. I mean, I think Plato and Socrates and Roman Marcus Aurelius talked about this, and I mean generals. Sun Tzu would talk about this. These are Lao Tzu. Many people from ancient Miyamoto Musashi would talk about these things. These are things that are ancient things. How much of your soul do you sacrifice to win the war? And that's what I think is Discovery's entire arc, and that's what I'm loving about it. So I want Lorca to be horrible because he's exploring that. That's what he's exploring. So,
but he's
don't get me wrong.
He's not just horrible. Like he's got this like I'm a good guy face that he puts on for people, but then he also has this like super dark side, which is fantastic.
That's what I'm saying is that from his point of view, it's critical. This is vital. You know what I mean? He's got to make sure that his crew is on board. He's got to make sure his crew understands that Korvan II is about to go. All these people, these little children, these little girls and little boys are about to become smeared into little dust particles, and you're going to hear the crunching of their little bones as this happens if you don't do this.
And I love
psychological horror.
And I love the effect it has on Stamets as he's walking back.
Yeah,
it's like you can see it. Like he's like holding back tears, and he's just like,
"This is killing him."
But it's great because he was so defiant just minutes earlier, and like Lorca knew how to like get him back on his side immediately.
Yeah, but it's dirty pool.
But it's so totally effective.
Dirty pool.
It's so effective, and it gets the whole ship. It gets the whole ship hyped up. To what they need to do. Like it's so well done.
It is beautiful. Like, it is a wonderfully well played scene.
No captain has ever been as hardcore as Lorca.
No, this captain is hardcore. This captain is seriously hardcore. I love him.
He is so
hardcore.
He is. I still think he's my favorite captain. Only two episodes. We've had seven seasons with most of the other captains, and two episodes. This guy is already like he's near and dear to my heart.
Well, and we thought that Sisko was pretty badass. Whenever Sisko was willing to do this, and he walked on this line.
Oh yeah.
And we were watching Sisko walk on this line, and what we're watching right now. And what makes my neck tingle here is the thought is that right now Burnham is our super good guy.
She's our super good. She's our moral compass. Like the person they've established is kind of the bad guy. She is kind of our moral compass now, which is crazy.
She's our good guy. But what I'm wondering is, in the end, is she going to develop into our Sisko? Willing to do what needs to be done, but in the end, is she going to be doing the things that is she going to be raising the glass at the end? You know, is that what she's going to be doing? You know,
I hope she kind of transitions into Lorca. I hope she does because Lorca,
well, not Lorca. I think she can't transition to Lorca. Lorca's gone.
I think I think Lorca's going to die at some point. I mean, like,
well, I have a feeling Lorca's destined to end it too. I think he's not going to make it.
Well, so Michael, I'm sure she's eventually going to be the captain, like if it does make it to seven seasons. But it's like, when does Lorca die and when does she take over from Lorca? And is she going to be the next Lorca? Like, being under him for like 5 or 6 years, is that going to make her – is she going to mirror him at the end, you know?
Well, I think that's going to be the struggle that character is going to have to pull through. And I'm going to love every second of this show if that's what they're doing. If they do that, I'm going to love every minute of this show because it's going to be the struggle of her character. And we're going to watch her pull this dynamic of not becoming Lorca, but still having to do what needs to be done.
But still having the Lorca-ism in her, yeah.
Yeah, be interesting. Having to do what needs to be done. Getting the crew to do what needs to be done without having to do
the things. I don't know. It'll be interesting. I hope he doesn't go soon. Like, I hope. I'm sorry. I keep pulling you right off. I hope Lorca makes it to at least the second to last season. I hope he doesn't die too soon because
we love Lorca.
Lorca's so amazing. Anyway, Valk and Laurel are on the records of the Shenzhou and they're at the dilithium processor. And Valk wonders if Laurel has doubted to Kuvma for naming Valk. And she basically tells him how she doesn't have a taste for leadership. She likes being the supporting structure for the leadership because it gives her so much more freedom to do what she needs to do. So they take that. And Burnham summons Saru to Lorca's room. And she keeps inching him closer to the beast's chamber. His threat ganglia don't react. So she's like, yeah, you know. She's trying to apologize to him, but she's also like, you know, leading him to a place that he doesn't really want to be. And so he's just like, oh, you know, you're going to fit right in with everybody here. You're an evil bastard, basically, is what he tells her. Because she's speaking like, oh, I want to apologize, but then you're doing something that's, you know, not cool to him, like putting him into a place where there's danger. But his threat ganglia don't react, so she's proved a point, but he's still not on her side. Tilly brings Burnham a canister of spores, and the creature seems to react interesting, like it eats them or like it sniffs them or something. So Burnham then goes to Stamets and shows him the footage of the Glen and shows that everything was broken from the inside out. So they figure out that the creature may interact with the spores in a certain way. So they beam the creature into the field of all the spores, and they do some readings on it, and they figure out that it's actually interacting with it. And there's some sort of symbiotic relationship between the spores and the creature itself. So that was really fascinating. Let me switch back to Valk and Laurel, and they get back to the Kuvma ship, and the Klingons are feasting. And Cole has brought them food. And basically, they've all pledged themselves to Cole because the price of loyalty is so low since they were starving. They're like, yep, we're signing up. Cole tells Laurel to kill Valk, but she steps in and she's like, you know, I've got a better idea. You could just exile him on the grave of that ship, the Shenzhou. They just leave him in the wreckage. And Cole's like, yeah, that's fitting.
That sounds like a great idea.
And then, you know, on the ship, Valk's like, this can't be the end. This can't be the end. And Laurel beams in. She's like, it's not the end. But you're going to have to give up everything to, you know, get anywhere in this life. And that's super interesting that she basically saved his life. And I feel like they're setting him up completely to be the albino from Blood Oath.
From Blood Oath. I think so, too.
Because, I mean, like...
He's been ostracized now. And I'm really thinking that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah, I heard on the Trek Geeks after discovering Trek show that they were thinking that after the first episode. Like, I didn't have anything in it to really make me think that it was going to be that albino. But now they're totally setting up for it without a doubt.
Well, if you think about what Dax said about the albino, she said he was a rogue element. Who had a bunch of people who was a rogue element who Kor and Kang and
Koloth
were sent to hunt him down, and they did, and he took revenge on them, and that was the whole point, was that they sent three Klingon ships to hunt him down. So,
but the thing is, I mean, like, it may be even more than that you're getting from this episode. I mean, like, Cole is of the House of Kor, so maybe, you know, the revenge he wanted, maybe Cole in the show dies sonless. So part of his reason for coming after Kor and Kor's son is because he couldn't hurt Kor. I mean, Cole anymore. And he couldn't hurt Cole's family, so he, the next best thing is, you know, a brother or cousin or something.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they could totally, like, set him up to be that albino, which is – super fascinating.
That would be really cool.
I would love.
And if you look at the pictures, they're similar. I mean, they do look similar. The albino in Discovery has no facial hair, obviously, or hair at all.
Yeah.
But somebody had posted somewhere this morning, I was just reading, that there was and I've got absolutely – so take this with a grain of salt. I've got absolutely no verification of it because I just got it this morning, that Viacom is involved in the purchasing of things. Now, I know an awful lot about the legal setup and structure of Star Trek, and I have not heard this. But – there was some discussion about how there is a legal right to whom owns the look of the Klingons, and CBS is not amongst those who now currently owns the look of the Klingons, and that's why they look different at this time. There is discussion that that might be part of what's going on, that it involves Viacom and the purchase that Viacom made a few years ago of CBS. And so because of that, that may be why the Klingons look different.
Well, what I heard is Brian Fuller made a mandate, so they had to look different. That's what I heard.
Well, that would be consistent with, and, you know, they no longer have the legal right to make them look the same, therefore, comma. So that would be consistent with it.
I hope they get that right back so they can start edging them to look more like the Klingons that we know. Because, I mean, I love the new way the makeup looks, and I love how alien they look. But, I mean, no eyebrows, no goatees or anything. I mean, I don't care if they're bald. But if they had, like, at least big eyebrows or big goatees, it's at least a nod that they have hair follicles. But they're making them look like they don't have hair at all. And, I mean, Kales cut his hair and made the first Batlath or whatever. When he stuck it in lava. So, I mean, like, Klingons having hair is integral to their lore.
Yeah. Well, it is. But, of course, you know, that was one of the arguments that somebody had also made was, you know, Klingons, their hair was very important to all Klingons. And I said, yeah, hair was very important to all humans, too. And then promptly put a picture of Sisko. You know, you could always argue that, you know, humans have gone through phases where we shaved all of our hair off, and then we went through phases where we had long hair, and then we went through phases where we shaved all of our hair off too.
So yeah, but not as every single member of the culture though.
Yeah, but, well, I'd be willing to believe. Yeah, but we have had multiple cultures too.
Yeah, but I mean, like, multiple cultures have different ways of doing things, and the Klingons, they showed all 24 houses, they're all bald, and I'm like,
yeah,
for every single one to do that's kind of weird, but, you know, if it is a legal thing, that makes a little bit more sense.
Well, right now, on the entire Earth, all of our women shave their armpits at this moment, so that is kind of a thing.
Well, isn't that more an American thing and less a European thing?
Yeah, well, and right now, well, and for the last, like, 50 years, that's been kind of a thing. Oh. But 50 years ago, that wasn't necessarily a thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, fashion changes a lot.
Fashion changes and things change. I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, and then, like, goatees are a thing now for a lot of, and as our communication spreads, a lot of people are doing goatees. You and I have goatees.
Yep.
But not full beards.
Well, I mean, I model all my hair off of Klingons. I mean, I've got the middle of my upper lip shaved. I mean, I've got the Klingon aesthetic going because I love the old Klingon aesthetic. Yeah, only thing I don't have is the ridges. I've got the long hair too. But back to Discovery. Discovery goes to Black Alert. They beam the tardigrade that was from the Glen to their reaction chamber. All the stuff starts working. And they have the full map, and they realize the tardigrade's got all these, you know, star charts and coordinates just in its head. And they're able to warp into the core of Antu, and they take out two Klingon bird of prey immediately. And they just sit there, just wait for the enemy to get closer and closer while they're getting hammered. Then they warp out with, like, three torpedoes just hanging there in the air, and they just blow the Klingons to hell. And it was fantastic. I love this scene so much. A lot of the scene from Coravan 2 reminds me a lot of Once More Into the Breach, when they're going behind the Cardassian lines. Like, the whole, like, the way they're raiding that planetary system, it's everything reminds me so much of that. in this episode.
I agree.
But I love how they just like lull them in to like this close thing, and then they all get blown up and they warp out, and all the people run out and they're like, "What happened? What happened? They're gone." And like, they don't know what happened. And it is so cool that like they're saved and they're happy, but nothing. They don't like, "Oh, we can't thank anybody. We don't know what happened." It's really cool. Back on the ship, Tilly comes to finds Burnham in the room, and she encourages her to open up the chest. The chest, you know, has a hologram of Captain Georgiou, you know, hoping that she's in command, and you know, all the things that she had hoped for her, which, you know, I'm sure kind of hurts Michael to hear, since she's not in that kind of good place. But inside the chest is the telescope that they were using in her ready room, and that's pretty much where it ends up for episode 4.
There we go, and that's our episode that I've interrupted you like 12 times on.
Yeah, and that's how it goes. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I interrupt Aaron, so I mean, that's just how the show goes. So forgive me if I'm a little stuttery going into the description. I'm not used to doing that. Aaron, your job is hard, and I really appreciate everything that you do.
Yeah.
With as much as I interrupt, I understand. So, like, this episode sets up so much. It blows me away how much stuff to set up. Like, the tardigrade, like, that creature.
That creature clearly is being exhausted doing this job, which is setting up the big moral quandary.
It's like a moral quandary.
Oh, I was going to say, when I write Tamerlan, it's quandaries like this that I love to explore. This is exactly what I like to explore in Tamerlan. It's these quandaries. Now it's the, hey, we can go anywhere in the universe at any time, but you're going to have to sacrifice a creature, a living creature, a creature that is intelligent and smart, and you're going to have to kill it every time you do that. Welcome to Starfleet. You know what I mean? And, like, this is the kind of stuff that's rich. This is rich. And that's – I can tell already that this is going to be the showdown between Lorca and Burnham. This is where it's going to be a showdown. Lorca is going to say, I don't care. The tardigrade is going to be sacrificed. That's the way it's going to be because – it's the war. And Burnham's going to be like, this is Starfleet. We don't sacrifice people to do the war. And Lorca's going to be like, it's not a people. It's a tardigrade. You know what I mean?
And she's going to be – and he's going to also – he might even at that point have to show the Section 31 thing where it's like, yeah, we go beyond – you know, what is – we go beyond what Starfleet requires to get what's necessary. There's so much stuff they could lead toward.
Yeah, the fact that the Discovery is 1031.
Oh, yeah.
Section, that's just beautiful.
Section 31.
The black badges on board.
Section 31.
They are. So not only that, the little things. Somebody had pointed out online the last scene in Context is for Kings that pulls out of that room.
Yeah.
That Lorca's in, his little menagerie, and the window. And underneath the window, there are three lines and one line.
Huh.
Just etched into the hull.
That's interesting.
So a three and a one underneath the hull. I mean, it's like everywhere. It's like, catch on, guys.
Section 31. Section 31.
It's everywhere.
I can't wait.
This ship is a Section 31 ship.
And the thing is, the tardigrade's going to die, and they're going to have to figure out where to get another one.
Yeah, they're just going to manufacture them. They're going to figure out where they – I mean, they were already sort of saying in this one – there was dialogue where they were doing where did the Glenn pick up the tardigrade?
Yeah.
And you can tell that that's going to be the next question. So where do we get another tardigrade? Because we're going to need that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So they're going to find them, and if they're going to keep sacrificing them, or, you know, if you get a bank of them, that way you don't have to kill them, just cycle them through each time. Yeah. So that
they can't keep them. That's the thing that's in and of itself might be the pseudo that might be the real beauty about Discovery,
mm-hmm,
being where it is. Everybody has been talking over and over and over about why is it they keep sticking it Why do they have to keep making a prequel? Why do they keep having making a prequel? And my response to that is, this might be why. Because had this been after Voyager, there would be no threat at all in the back of your brain to the idea that maybe they just invent a new warp drive that runs off of the tardigrade.
Mm-hmm.
But you know damn well that in 10 years, there is no warpy around the universe at super speeds with little tardigrades hanging out in the bottom. There was no tardigrade that Scotty was feeding.
Nope.
So the end result of Discovery is the tardigrade's gone. Michael Burnham, if there's a showdown between Burnham and Lorca over whether Lorca keeps the tardigrade and just kills tardigrades over and over and over again, or Burnham says that we can't do that because we're Starfleet, Burnham's going to win this war between the two of them. You know it in your heart.
Either she's going to win the war or they're all going to die, and or
something horrible is going to happen.
But the thing is, I don't think it ever goes away. I think Section 31 just takes sole proprietary of the tardigrade spore device, because right. I think that's how Sloan shows up in Bashir's quarters all the time with, like, you
that
know
might be, that actually would be oh that I that
with,
oh.
with no announcement. Oh. And the thing is, tardigrades are the ones we know in real life. They're microscopic organisms. So, I mean, right. like they're bending science and Discovery to make giant tardigrades to make it do what they do. And so they don't have to miniaturize the process in Deep Space Nine. The catalyst is already miniaturized. All you got to do is miniaturize everything else around it. And then you've got Section 31.
They probably have tardigrades that they're sacrificing in Deep Space Nine, and we just don't talk about it.
And they're just – it's Section 31. They're just doing it. And that's how Sloan escapes the Cardassian – I mean, was it Cardassian or the Romulan execution? Like, it looks like he dies, and he just, like, beams out. Like, he probably planted another one of those devices on someone else to warp them in, to have them melt on that Romulan chair, and he just warps out, you know?
No, I'm with you. Like, I'm totally with you.
Like, I think right. I think the tardigrade thing just
– that is exactly how Sloan keeps showing up in places that he shouldn't be showing up in. He's using a tardigrade transporter.
So I think
– showing up in Bashir's quarters.
Yeah. I think that's how it's got to be. I mean, it just – it fails on a massive scale, so it doesn't get replicated to other ships. But it's just – Section 31 just keeps it.
It's morally – inept. It's morally corrupt, so it can't be used. Starfleet can't use it. It's like the Starfleet's got a lot of technology that we've already proven by canon that they can't use. They don't have cloaking devices.
Yeah, but they also
could. The Defiant has a cloaking device.
Well, they borrowed it from the Romulans, but yeah.
Right, but I mean, it's and well, Kirk stole a cloaking device.
That's true.
In 2268, I mean, it's not like they don't have cloaking devices. They've had cloaking devices everywhere, but because of the Treaty of Algernon, they don't use the cloaking device. So, I mean, it's not like Starfleet doesn't hang out having it. You know what I mean?
I just don't understand how they ended up signing the treaty where they don't get to use it, but every single other race that's not part of the Federation doesn't. Who'd they sign the treaty with?
What really cracks me up is I'm reading the books that take place after Deep Space Nine. Which are great books, the phenomenal books, all of the Kittimer Accord books and all that stuff, that the Kittimer Pact
mm-hmm.
books that take place in the Typhon.
The Typhon Pact? Yeah. Typhon Pact books. I haven't read those, but I read the
– Eat them. Oh, they're beautiful.
I read the Discovery Trilogy, which takes place right before that. The one where they kill the Borg, the one that shows the right. creation of the destruction of the Borg. Those are the right. Destiny Trilogy. Those were fantastic books. Destiny I love them.
Trilogy. Destiny Trilogy with the Aventine, and then after that is the Kittimer Pact, and you need to read that those two. I'm reading those now, but I love the fact that it's all set around the Typhon group, which is the Tholians, the Zenkethi, and the Romulans, and the Breen. They've all gathered together to form this pact to that are against the Federation, And they're upset because they have slipstream technology. The Federation has slipstream technology. And the whole point is that they've been trying to get the slipstream technology because it gives them an upper hand. And through the whole thing, I keep thinking, don't they have cloaking devices?
Exactly.
Like, isn't that technically an upper hand? And not only that, I mean, you know, and of course, while we're at it, of course, the Tal Shiar is using their phase cloak, which is even weirder cloaking technology, which allows them to move through other spacecraft. And I'm like, see, they're sitting here being – but of course, that's true to real life. I mean, you know, you sit there and you
– I got
to
have it all.
Yeah, you fear the opponent has that one thing that gives superiority when it really doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, and so – I find all of this to be amazing on a high scale. But that's the thing I think I'm liking the most about Discovery, is for the first time in a long time, probably since the Dominion War, and in fact I think it's been since the Dominion War, I feel like I am sitting here trying to second guess what our commanders are doing, what people are doing, what the characters are doing. Lorca has gone both directions on me. I thought I had him figured out in Context is for Kings. He turned around and went the other direction on me. And he's going a deeper way, and I like him a whole lot better. I mean, I don't like him, which makes me like him. You know what I mean? I don't like his character because he is a manipulative jerk. But he's doing it to get his way, and I love that.
It's like I would hate him if I was like on his ship and I had to do what he said. Like, he would not be like my captain. Like, I would prefer like Picard to be my captain. But as an outside person looking in, he is so much more interesting than any of the other captains combined.
Right. He's not the way Julie Cochran would run her ship. We know that.
Yeah.
Now, Julie Cochran would always be the captain I would want, but that's why I write her, right? She's the captain I would want on my ship. Okay, that makes sense. But Lorca is a beautiful captain. I'm loving him. I hate him, but I love to hate him. You know, and I don't even hate him.
I just love every single thing about him. Like, it's just like I would hate him if I was in – but I don't have to hate him because I can just love him. And I love his layers.
Well, that's what I mean, is that, you know, it's been a long time since I've had a character that I've watched and said, yeah, I really wouldn't want to be a character underneath this character, you know, serving on this ship. And yeah, the Butcher's Knife, definitely. This is definitely making me think this. The next episode's called Choose Your Pain, and I'll bet you anything if that is definitely referencing
the struggle between keeping the tardigrade alive and not.
Yeah. We're definitely going to try to be keeping that tardigrade alive. There's nothing on, I haven't seen. It's interesting, the first four episodes, there was a lot of immediate chatter. I mean, like the first four episodes were released, the information of the first four were released in a block. And we've now reached the end of the block, and I have heard nothing about the next four episodes.
Been the next five episodes since they're doing nine in the block, and then they're going to have the break.
Yeah, but I've seen nothing about the next episode at all. I am definitely – yeah, and don't get me wrong. I am absolutely on board with Lorca. I love to hate him. I hate him, and I love it.
I love him so much. He's so good. He's so manipulative, and it's just like, you know, it's not the qualities you want to have in a Starfleet captain, but it's just, it's different. It's different, and I think that's why he's so good. I mean, every captain has had their own unique personality, but they've been kind of one-dimensional. You know what I mean? Right. Like, I mean, Kirk, I love Kirk. He's great. He's got the swagger. He's got, like, the know-how. He's super intelligent. But he's always pretty much been the same. Yeah. Janeway, same way. Sisko, he breaks the rules here and there. He's kind of like Kirk, but he's not multi-layered like Lorca. Like Lorca, Lorca's just different, so much more different than anything we've gotten in Star Trek. And I think I love it because it is so different and so new, and in a way it's fresh.
Well, and that's the whole thing, is that – the thing about Lorca, well, the thing about each captain in their own way is that they have their own personality and their own design. And you can't always have Boy Scouts. Starfleet is about Boy Scouts.
Yeah.
But you want Starfleet to be about your heroes, but there are always going to have to be underneath the heroes. There had to be the people who just got the job done. They did the dirty work and they got the job done. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so great about this is Burnham went in there, and we saw this in Contexts for Kings, right? We saw her say, "I'm the hero. I know you think I'm not the hero because I, you know, tried to knock out my captain and started a war and stuff like that. But I was misunderstood. In reality, I'm a hero." Mm-hmm. And Lorca is like, "No, I gotcha." But I don't think Lorca got her. And I think really we really did get a Lorca didn't get her. But Burnham, I think, is definitely Captain Kirk. They're setting her up to be the Captain Kirk Boy Scout. And they're going to put her directly in conflict with Lorca. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They're gonna put her. Lorca is Sisko in his worst position during Deep Space Nine, when we were in that worst place.
That Pale Moonlight episode,
his darkest, right? When Sisko had to decide whether he was going to kill Vrenak or not.
Yeah, you
know, that was the darkest point. The darkest point where Sisko had to do what he had to do.
And the thing is, I think Lorca is going to get even darker, which is going to be so much fun. It's going to be so much fun on that ride. Not only
that, Sisko didn't want to do that, and Lorca is totally willing to do that. He'll do that in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah.
Lorca won't even think twice about it. Lorca won't slow down. Sisko would have slowed down and stopped and said, maybe not. But Lorca, right past that.
Oh yeah, like I love everything out of Lorca's mouth is just fantastic. It just like from one of his first lines this episode where he's just like, "Yeah, it'd be hard to do worse on that simulation." I'm just like, "Yes, yes, just break your whole crew's balls!" Like it's just I love Lorca so much.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Like it's sad though. I mean, like I know Michael's supposed to be the main character, but I'm just like, I mean, she's great. I mean, Sequoia Martin, Sonequa Martin Green, she's a fantastic actress. I like her as Michael Burnham, but Jason Isaacs steals every single scene he's in though.
Well, he does. He's strong, and it's the same thing with Leonard Nimoy. Leonard Nimoy stole the scenes too from Bill Shatner. That's not uncommon. The truth of the matter is, though, the web of Discovery is hanging on Burnham.
Yeah.
And Will. And I know that. I can see that no matter how much we love Jason Isaacs or Michelle Yeoh, because, oh my God.
I love Michelle Yeoh, too. I thought she was great.
Oh my God. Michelle Yeoh is so – she's one of my favorite – she's been one of my favorite characters or actresses forever and ever and ever in a day. And she clearly, I mean, especially the cameo that she did in this episode, I mean, that brought me to tears. I was like, I just could we just have her like be the little artificial like Obi-Wan Kenobi ghost so she can just come back every so often and go, "Michael, that's not a good choice." Because I just want to see her. I mean, I know that's not Star Trek, but my God, it was so good to see her again. It was so great to have her back. And it was wonderful to have her there. And I know that it doesn't fit Star Trek, and it won't fit Star Trek, and we can't have her. But God, it was good to see her.
Oh, it absolutely was.
This is Michael's show. I mean, this is all about Michael Burnham, and it's all about having Burnham in there. And Burnham's coming back, and it will be about Burnham in the end, and it will be all about Burnham. And I get that, and I love Jason Isaacs too. And don't get me wrong, it's going to be gorgeous. I don't know where I was headed with that one. The train just went totally off the rails. Sorry.
I feel like the ensemble is super tiny in the show. I feel like there's just Lorca, Saru, Anthony Rapp's character Stamets, and Michael. I feel like there's just four main characters in the show.
No, we've got our cadet. We got our cadet Tilly.
Oh yeah, Tilly. That's true. Like she.
Tilly. We got Tilly. We've got her. We had our security officer. She just got mauled.
She's dead. So yeah, that's the thing.
I mean, I'm bummed by that because I liked her a lot.
I liked her too. I liked. She's the badass security guard. She's the Tasha we should have had.
Yeah, but I get the feeling that they're cycling. We'll get more characters.
Sure.
We're gonna get more people. Because I know that Harry Mudd's on the horizon.
Oh, Harry Mudd's going to be in the next episode. It looks like they capture Jason Isaacs in the next episode. They capture Lorca. And he gets put in the same jail cell with Mudd. And I'm like, when do Klingons take prisoners?
Yeah, lights. For it all. Klingons don't take prisoners, Mr. Savick. Klingons do take prisoners, I think. Actually, they have taken prisoners in the past. Otherwise, you wouldn't have Ruapenthe.
I guess so, but I mean, like, maybe they're on their way to Ruapenthe, I guess, but I don't know. It just seems kind of strange because they're also, like, looks like they're doing, like, a Romulan torture on him where they pry open his eyes like they did with Geordi.
Yeah.
Because the little bit we saw in the preview, I was like,
I haven't – I actually intentionally did not watch the preview,
oh,
so
I'm sorry. I lost
it. No, it's all good. You can tell me all you want. I just – didn't watch it, so I'm a completely lost dude.
It just looks like they're torturing Lorca like the same way they it looks like they're torturing Lorca a very similar way that the Romulans tortured Geordi. And then they showed Mudd in the preview, which I'm so excited to see Harry Mudd. Although I'm kind of sad that he's a prisoner. I kind of want to see him in his own element and not out of his own element, because that's what makes Harry Mudd so much fun, is that he's sort of in control of these wacky situations.
Yeah, well, you know,
and then he gets caught by, you know, the Federation, but this time it looks like he starts off being caught by Klingons. I'm like, huh, that's interesting. So I'm definitely looking forward to see how next episode plays out, especially getting some Harry Mudd action. I love Harry Mudd.
Yeah, I agree. Harry Mudd's going to be interesting. It's very ensemble, they've got a very small ensemble. But what I am saying, though, what I am seeing is we're four episodes in, and we have some very rich characters of those four ensemble.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Lorca is we've sat here and talked for a good 15, 20 minutes on Lorca. And Tilly is a very rich character, even if she is kind of wild and woolly, and I don't know what she's doing on a black ops ship.
Yeah, a cadet. What is a cadet doing on a black ops ship? That's,
I don't know. She has something specific she is doing on that ship that we don't know anything about yet.
Maybe Stamets requested her. Maybe.
Yeah, there's got to be a reason why she's there. She said something about her being really smart about something.
Yeah.
But what she's doing on a black ops ship when she can't keep her mouth shut is beyond me. But that's an interesting thing.
Well, she's on Stamets' crew, so I would assume at this point that Stamets has particularly recruited her based on something that he saw on her record.
Because, yeah, there's something about Stamets
because
wanting
her
for some reason.
Because if she's not even an ensign yet, she's just a cadet, so I'm like, that's kind of weird.
Yeah, she doesn't – yeah. We've seen, but she's a fascinating and intriguing character. They've really fleshed her out really well. Stamets drives me absolutely bonkers, but he drives me bonkers because he's got the military discipline of my cat. I mean, you know, but it makes sense. He was a science officer on a science ship doing science and being perfectly content. And then some idiot started a war. And I get it. I mean, he makes total sense. So he's belligerent and irritating, and they can't drum him out because they need him. And he knows it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so they can't drum him out. And so he can be a jerk, and he is a jerk. And so Lorca has resorted to dirty pool to keep him under control. And I find that dynamic to be awesome. I really am finding that fascinating. I love the character work there. that's just really fun.
It's so rich. Like, everything about the show is so rich.
And Saru and Burnham, that dynamic there, it's a standoff right now. But there's a lot they're going to work into. You can see they're going to work into that. They're going to be playing a lot. They're heading that way.
Gotcha.
So that's my analysis on this. That's where I'm thinking we're going on this one, is those two spots. That's where I'm thinking we are.
Yeah, I think so too. Anyway, yeah, this episode has been fantastic, and if they keep going this route, I am so sold. Like, this show is so good. Like,
oh yeah.
I was worried a little bit, you know, to be honest. Like, you know, I was excited for it, I was worried, but after last episode, all my worry went away. And after this week's episode, I'm just more and more excited for each additional episode. It just keeps building, and it's absolutely fantastic.
It is. It is.
And it's incredible. We do have an email from my brother. This is from the first episode that he heard. And we didn't get to read it last time because we started recording really late. So here it is. So, he said he heard our episode on Discovery. Interesting discussion. Personally, I thought just about every aspect of the show was amazing. It may have even exceeded my expectations because I try not to get too excited about watching anything, although it was very difficult for the first Trek series in over a decade. But being neutral with expectations helps me enjoy a movie or show for what it is, and it almost seems the logical emotions that may cloud my judgment to a minimum. Both of you had problems with the pacing of the show, which is understandable to a degree, but I felt like it was appropriate for a pilot episode. It's much harder to get a target audience to feel for a character in a long-running show if they don't know anything about the background of the character or the characters and their relationships with the other characters. There's an endless amount of amazing shows that started out with a very similar pacing, very similar to this. I felt like the goal was to give the audience, make them feel a shit about Michael Burnham and understand and empathize with her about why she did what she did, which is what the show accomplishes beautifully. That's the kind of stuff that makes people want to keep watching a TV series. And yes, the pacing with the Klingon story did make it feel like they were kind of just sitting there forever, not doing anything. And yes, the ordinarily should not be the case. I felt like it was excusable, first of all, because the Klingon clans are not on the same page, so they were going back and forth with each other. And secondly, because I'm pretty sure there's a Klingon flashback or two mixed in with that scene, which they could have rearranged to make it flow a little bit better, I guess. I'm sure they could have, but it's still cool they went through all the trouble setting up the story with the enemy. I feel like it's something that previous Trek iterations haven't really done before. The fact the series, or at least the season, is about the war doesn't bother me either. It's not like the first time we've seen war in Star Trek, even though they didn't start off that way in Deep Space Nine, is also about war. And it wasn't just one season either. It was a major theme for the whole series. Believe me, I understand the reason why it's putting off some people. I love the peaceful space exploration aspect of Star Trek as much as the next fan. But like it or not, the Klingon Federation War is still part of Star Trek history and a topic worthy to dive into. The Klingons are, as far as I can tell, the most popular Star Trek alien. Who wouldn't want a history lesson seeing where they are concerned? Speaking of Klingons, their old school look with the plain faces, forehead ridges, and hair worthy of 80s thrash metal performer will always have a special nostalgic place in my ever. However, I dig the new look. The elongated heads, misshapen facial features, and the lack of hair make them look more alien and not just human with a plastic forehead. Even their voices sound more alien. I know there's a lot of haters out there, especially when it comes to the new look of Klingon. But come on. And I believe Aaron pointed out in the episode, the show is evolving, and it's not a bad thing. If it didn't evolve, Klingons would still look like white people with blackface, and no one wants that. I thought the morality discussion between Burnham and the computer was a nice touch, mostly because it's nice not the TOS, the times Kirk outlogic the machine. I didn't feel like it went on for too long, but then again, the idea of a human owning a computer in a battle with wits, owning a computer in a battle of wits amuses me to no end. And if memory serves, there's old conversations where Kirk lasted even longer. One last thing, y'all are worried that the show isn't doing well enough to thrive because it wasn't good enough. I think at this point, you can put the worry to rest. The Discovery pilot got 8 million views, and the record for all SX subscribers was shattered. But let me put this to you in perspective for you. The series premiere, Game of Thrones, got only 2 million views. Game of Thrones is now the most popular show on TV of all time. I know y'all like to read emails, but seldom get them, so I'm hoping y'all don't mind reading the emails that are 56 pages long to make up for it. Keep up the good work. Look forward to your coverage of future episodes and the course of the episodes themselves. Yeah, thank you for the email. It's always good getting email and getting to read responses on the air. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I was harder on the first couple episodes, but I was definitely harder on them because I was trying to look at them as a non-fan and trying that free episode to get new people to subscribe. And that's why I was a lot harder on it. I do love the look of the new Klingons. I'm a little sad there's no hair, but we talked about that a little bit earlier today on the show. So
yeah, but I think that that's just going to be, you know, maybe they're just going through a non-hair phase. You know what I mean? Maybe we'll have hair later.
Yeah, I mean that's good. It got 8 million views, but I mean also. It's 8 million views on a channel people get with their cable package automatically, whereas HBO people had to pay for $15 bucks a month, even with a cable package. So, I mean, it's a little unfair comparing the two, I think, where CBS is a channel everyone has, whereas again, you know, HBO isn't. And also, Game of Thrones is also one of the most popular one of the most pirated television shows out there.
Yeah,
it's
getting pirated as well, which is sad, but
it is sad. But I mean, with Game of Thrones, nothing is like Game of Thrones. Like it blew everyone's expectations out of the water. Even people that don't like the fantasy genre, it sucked them in because it wasn't too heavy on the fantasy. I mean, you had some fantastical elements in Game of Thrones, but it didn't get super fantasy until this last season. This last season felt full on Dungeons and Dragons to me. Or like, you know, the battles take forever, but traveling, you know, took seconds.
Right. I understand that I had HBO for last year I had HBO, but then I had to renegotiate my deal with Comcast, which is our local provider. So I didn't get HBO this season. So I have not seen the most recent season of Game of Thrones. So don't spoil.
Oh, I'm sorry, but I'm just saying.
It's all good.
It feels more like D&D. Like in that fantasy realm than any of the other seasons did.
Well, that's good because I'm a D&D player.
I love D&D, but I mean, like I liked how the previous seasons of Game of Thrones felt a little bit more real because travel took a long time. But I don't know. But yeah, Game of Thrones, it's a little bit unfair to compare them, I think. But I mean, it's a good point. I mean, but hopefully, I know they said that they broke records on their sign-up for a day, but I mean, they still haven't released numbers. I mean, the last number.
Really? I don't think they will. And I don't think they have to. They don't have to tell us diddly.
Well, I mean, they did say they had over 1 million subscribers before Star Trek because I guess people were watching The Good Wife or whatever that exclusive show they have on there. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But I mean, they gave us numbers before Discovery, but they haven't given us numbers after Discovery. So we have no idea what the All Access subscribers look like as a total. Yeah. So I don't know, I kind of hope they tell us something. Like I would love to see that season two being confirmed because this is an absolutely amazing series. And I have gone back and rewatched the first two episodes a couple times. I like them so much more upon repeat viewings than I did on my initial viewing.
Right. Right.
So also, Josh and you know other people who listen to the show, like we may have been a little bit harsher on it because like we literally watched it and then watched both episodes once, went to sleep, woke up, and started talking about it first thing in the morning. So there was no repeat viewing time. It was like first initial reactions, and that's all there was. And the same thing with Context is for Kings. We watched the episode and we literally recorded as soon as we were done watching it. So there's no time to rewatch it. It was immediate thoughts. We're trying to get these done as out as quickly as possible after they come out. So, and very similar. We're recording this the Monday after. So I did get to watch this one a second time, but it's just, I mean, we're doing initial reactions, and so sometimes repeat viewings makes things sink in better or make things seem better on the surface. So. That's maybe why our first episode came out the way it did, where we sounded a little bit negative. We love it, but we super love episode 3 and episode 4. Oh my gosh!
Well, they changed the dynamic
completely.
They really changed the dynamic, you know.
Completely, absolutely.
They're really working on this. So it's once we hit episode 3 and 4, everything really changed. The entire feel of the show changed. And like I said, you compare the Vulcan Hello and the Battle of the Binary Stars with, say, the Emissary or
Encounter at Farpoint or
any of them, you know, the Broken Bow or any of those other, any of the other two parters which begin, and it doesn't really compare one to one very well.
It doesn't, you know, because episode 3 was actually the real pilot, you know?
Yeah. Well, and what's interesting is looking up the episode on Wikipedia, it's somewhere it said in here that the third episode was intended to be the pilot.
The second pilot. Yeah, I mean, the writers have said that. Pilot. They're saying it's the second pilot.
Right, here we go.
So, I mean, yeah.
The series writers consider this episode to be the show's equivalent of a pilot, including a majority of its main cast, the titular Starship Discovery, and the beginning of the season-long story.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, yeah, it's definitely different where they spent the first two episodes as a prologue. We've never had a prologue in Star Trek before. It was always like, oh, here's the ship, here's the adventure, go. And so Star Trek Discovery did something completely different, which isn't bad. I just definitely had a... I was trying to look at an outside person looking in,
sure,
instead of watching it as a Star Trek fan on initial viewing. But yeah, thank you for the email. It's always great hearing from you hearing what people think. And anyone else, if you want to email us, feel free to email us at synthaholics@yahoo.com. And do you have anything else about the show you need to say, Guy?
No. I'm really enjoying it. I'm looking forward to more episodes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can't wait.
Cool. Yeah. I'm really excited.
It's such a great thing to have Star Trek on. I just really want that season 2 confirmation so I can be jived for next season.
For next season.
Yeah. I don't want it to be canceled after one season. I'll cry.
I honestly, contrary to what chatter is going on outside there, I don't think they're going to cancel it after this first season. I think they're good. I think they're good to the second season. I don't think it's going to be a problem.
I mean, I think they are too, but I'm just the longer they wait to announce a second season, the more I get worried, you know? I mean,
the more we all sit here and what's going on. Yeah. Well, what I'm worried about is that they're going to play this game that everybody else is doing, which is wait a year between seasons. That's starting to really bother me. You know, it's the...
Especially with how short they are.
Yeah, they're 10 episodes every other year now. I mean, we've gone from 26 episodes a year to 10 episodes every other year. And I mean, in like the span of 2 years.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, well, I mean, technically, if they start the third season, I mean, if they start the second season in January of 2019, it'll be a year after the show has ended instead of like a year and a half, you know. I mean, it sounds worse than it is, because I mean, we're not getting the second half of this season until beginning of next year anyway.
Yeah, but even then, it's kind of like I'm kind of concerned about this ongoing theory that we've got with television now for smaller seasons and skipping years.
Yeah, that is kind of annoying. I hope it's not that long await, but we'll have to wait and see, and hopefully they'll announce a season 2 soon. I'm so excited whenever that gets official, because I want more Star Trek. I love Star Trek, and it's just been such an amazing ride so far with Discovery.
It has been. It has really been. It's been a great ride.
Thank you for joining me this week, Guy.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Our intros, what have I... Dave Wilkes. The rest of our music is provided by Warp 11. You can find them at warp11.com or Warp 11 on Twitter. The show you can find on Twitter at Synthaholic Duo. Personally, I'm David_J_Duncan. Guy?
You can find me at GS Davis Art pretty much everywhere. And you can also find me at USS Tamerlan on Facebook and Twitter. And, well, that's pretty much it.
Fantastic. Well, if you like the show, please go on iTunes and rate us and review us so we can be found in the algorithm more easily. It's a huge help, even if you don't primarily listen to us on iTunes. iTunes is what fuels all the other algorithms, so stars and reviews on that platform is super appreciated. If you would like to donate to us financially and help keep the lights on, we have a Patreon, patreon.com/synthaholics. So you can find us there. And you also have a Patreon as well, Guy.
Yes, I do. I have a Patreon as well for my artwork for my comics. You can find that at patreon.com/GSDavisArt.
Absolutely. So definitely check out Tamberlin if you haven't already. Guy does amazing work with that and his comic. And how's Witches of Flames going?
It'll be launching in January, January 1st.
Fantastic. Keep an eye out on all of this and more. Guy's also the host of the Rocky Mountain Geek Tank podcast.
Yep, you can find that at RockyMountainGeekTank.com.
Join the Facebook group at Facebook.com/group/Synthaholics. We have a good time there. We post actual science, discovery news. We have just spoiler forums so people can talk about anything they want about discovery. And it is a lot of fun on the group. So please come and give us a like. Come join us and join in the conversation as well there. And thank you all for listening. Live long and prosper, one and all. You're the best drinking friend I ever had.